also in 1826, there came the happiest of coincidences. And this may be the very moment at which Shakespeare's bust in the church in Stratford-upon-Avon first started to smile. July 1826, because then also were written the two main Schubert Shakespeare settings. And it was also from the Schlegel Antique translation that came to the attention of Schubert in Vienna through his friend Eduard Bauernfeld, who was part of the translating team. And there's a story that Schubert wrote down this marvelous setting, who is Sylvia, just as soon as he finished reading the German text. And certainly the manuscript looks very like a first draft, and at the same time, a complete and polished work of art. I want to draw your attention to the kinship between his mind and Mendelssohn's. It sees and illuminates things in a single flash, like lightning. And what that flash does is to link the words on the printed page with the notes on the written score. Of course, there are elements of descriptive or program music in Who is Sylvia? Because, after all, it is a serenade and it's just supposed to sound like one, but the response goes deeper than that. In every sense, the music sets the scene. Schubert would have known from the play how the song fits into its dramatic context in The Two Gentlemen of Verona. The music's part of the action. Now must we to her window and give some evening music to her ear. Enter musicians. We're told there's a little band on them, and their leader says, let's tune and to it lustily a while. The stage direction then says that the musicians play, and we know there has to be quite a long prelude. It has to leave enough time for stage dialogue before the singing begins. Then comes the song, which has three verses, and then follows a final postlude during which the characters on stage discuss the nature of music and of love, and I'm sure that Schubert had looked at all that and absorbed it. His prelude tells us that he's imagined the group of players as a band, a Mozart wind or string band with a cello or bassoon playing the bass line, and so on, and the chords are all struck together in a perfect ensemble, ideally. These are practiced professional musicians, we ought to understand, specially recruited for the occasion, giving of their best. I hear a melody in the little finger. As if that's played by a separate instrument. And I hear the same instrument expertly echoing the solo voice. Again, like that. Instrument to make a loving duet. The music seems to nod appreciatively. It says, yes, that's Sylvia, all right. No wonder all our swains commend her. And it appears from the manuscript that that effect was an afterthought. But it was a Shakespearean thought, I think, and it follows on the same logical lines. This is a highly skilled and polished ensemble. And the music, Shakespeare also tells us, though a serenade sometimes seems a little sad. In C sharp minor. The lady being serenaded is actually called Julia. She's saying to herself, who is Sylvia? And she may well ask. And we also know from the play that the music, it has to be Italian. It's from somewhere between Milan and Verona. So it's not a coincidence that we hear long melody notes and runs. Rising and falling octaves, and so on, in minims at the end of each verse. And these are written in Italian operatic melody, not at all suited to the German words as such. Indeed, I think they're absolutely impossible as settings of Das hier alles Untertan. But there they are, and they're there, because that actual melody reminds us so strongly of a, and it reminds Mozart so strongly, of a Mozart Italian opera. At the end of Dalla Subace, which has exactly those same tender sentiments and courtly compliments, and it's also a sort of serenade. Now, I think Schubert actually uses in his mind this same wind or string band for Hark, Hark, the Lark, because it's scored in the same way. It's economically reused. That's an ovade, a morning serenade, expressly designed to rouse the lady from her slumbers, as the words make clear, and here again Schubert follows Shakespeare, as well as Mozart, in writing for a high voice, an aria for a high voice. It's a eunuch, the clown tells us, in Symphony, though commentators aren't sure whether to take it entirely literally or not. No doubt the singer would have been a boy soprano, but in both songs the voice is made to show off. It shows off its sustained high notes, repeated, and the whole section is repeated. It shows off its grace notes. And also there's a various sort of cello melodies. Or, in the left hand, it's the same band and it's the same scoring. And I bet Schubert discussed those two songs with his friend Edward Bauernfeld, who was himself a devoted lover of Italian art and literature. Now, in Schubert's mind, those two marvellous songs, I think, form a matching pair. That is to say, serenades for morning and evening performed by the same company of Italian musicians. And they have actually the same motif. And the rising octave motif in both of them links those two songs throughout, and also the same echoes. What perfect numbers they would have made for the Shakespeare opera that Schubert, alas, never wrote. Now, he knew nothing of the Mendelssohn masterpiece I've already mentioned, but Schumann did. Schumann loved and admired both Mendelssohn and Shakespeare, and he wrote long essays on both of them. Schumann's own glorious year of songwriting actually began with a Shakespeare setting, that is, Feste's final farewell to the audience in Twelfth Night, when that I was and a little tiny boy. It was composed in February 1840, and the music sounds to me like the minutes of a meeting of two musical minds. In fact, we know from a diary entry that Schumann had met Mendelssohn the evening before that song was composed, the very evening before. And they left no written note or record of their discussion, but this song music and its date together tell us, I think, what that topic must have been. Schumann at that time, he had grave misgivings about writing Lieder, or vocal music in general. It seemed to him an inferior art form. But Mendelssohn knew better. He'd already set the words of Shakespeare, the Bible, Heine, Goethe, and he was famous for doing so. And he knew that words and music, great words and good music, could be equal partners in the song form, adding structure and stature to the other. And Schumann's own songwriting, which began on the very next day, begins by drawing on exactly those sources, the Bible, Goethe, Heine, and Shakespeare. It cannot be coincidence. And the music tells us equally that Schumann has actually caught fire from Mendelssohn's own example. This is how the donkey brays in the Midsummer Night's Dream overture. This is how Schumann's piano part begins. In his mind, this is the comic music of a Shakespeare clown, explicitly appropriate, capering about. This is how Mendelssohn follows his idea, with an English dance. And this is how Schumann's song begins. Almost exactly the same notes, or in almost exactly the same key. Now, this is all entirely unconscious, I'm sure, but it's all the more sincere and noteworthy for that. This is exactly how the creative musical mind responds to external influences, ideas, and images.